This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In just about 3 minutes on Fresh Air, I'm going to be joined by a very special guest. His name is David Eisenson, and you may be familiar with him and his work for a couple of reasons. You may be familiar with his bass playing in the 1960s. He spent a number of years with the Ornette Coleman Trio. He went on and recorded with many other people and has formed some groups of his own. We're going to be listening to some tapes of his music from his own collection, things that have not been released on record, a very special opportunity to hear this music. He's also a psychotherapist now, having received his doctorate in the late 1960s. And one of the groups that he's formed now is called Pot Smokers Anonymous, which is a series of workshops and counseling sessions in which he tries to help people who smoke a lot of dope and who feel that it's clouding their thoughts and actions stop smoking. So we'll be talking about that all in just about 4 minutes. But first, we're going to listen to a recording which he made with the Ornette Coleman Trio in England in the mid-1960s. Now, last Thursday on Fresh Air, at about 3:30 till about 4 o'clock, on Interval, Francis Davis played a number of out-of-print recordings with David Eisenson and Ornette Coleman. This is one of the recordings that he played. It's called Sadness. It's arranged by David Eisenson, and it's a very extraordinary recording. We've just heard Sadness with Ornette Coleman, Charles Moffett on drums, and my guest David Eisenson on bass, and he arranged the piece that we just heard. David Eisenson was born and grew up in Pittsburgh. He graduated from the Carnegie Institute with a scholarship to continue his studies on bass at the Manhattan School of Music, so he moved to New York in 1961, and he joined Ornette Coleman's group in 1962 with the trio that included Charles Moffett. It was a group that astounded audiences here and abroad, and their recorded work continues to astound listeners like myself. After not recording for a period of about 4 years, the trio gave their first London concert, from which we just heard a recording. On the basis of that concert, Ornette Coleman was named Musician of the Year and Melody Maker, and David Eisenson was named New Star of the Year. That was their first real poll recognition. Eisenson later in 1968 was named Bass Player of the Year in Downbeat. Well, that same year, 1968, the Ornette Coleman trio broke up with Eisenson and Moffett. David Eisenson decided to go back to school and begin a new career in addition to his career as a musician. He studied psychotherapy and he became Dr. David Eisenson, and after becoming the director of a senior citizen center, he began a private practice. He still has a private practice and has started a group called Pot Smokers Anonymous. In this group, he tries to help people stop smoking who smoke too much dope and find that it's clouding their operations. He says he would like to decommercialize dope. Maybe you saw him discuss this aspect of his work recently on The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder. Well, this doesn't mean that he stopped playing. He formed a quintet of his own with Barry Altschul, Carl Berger, and Gatto Barbieri. However, the group didn't record. Recently, he recorded an album with Paul Modian, and about 2 years ago in Philadelphia, they played at the Foxhole. David Eisenson is also a father. His son was diagnosed at the age of 2 as being severely mentally retarded. This has involved David in a regimen of exercises with his son. Actually, 60 friends and volunteers come to his home each week to work with his son Solomon, whose program of constant exercise and rehabilitative therapy has been prescribed by the Institute for the Achievement of Human Potential, which is located here in Philadelphia. This afternoon, we're going to be talking about all the aspects of David Eisenson's career, music and psychotherapy, and I'm hoping that he will be able to join us again to talk more specifically about Pot Smokers Anonymous, probably on Friday afternoon at about 4 o'clock, but we're going to have to make that definite a little later on so I can tell you more definitely about that tomorrow on Fresh Air. David Eisenson, it's really a great pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. It is an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to start a few years ago with your playing and work our way up to your present playing and to your work as a psychotherapist. You had a classical music training, which people refer to as legitimate training. How did that, do you think, affect your jazz, your approach to your instrument, and your experimentation with the bass?
I think I was very fortunate in having chosen the instrument bass, or did the bass choose me? I'm not really sure, but it was a love at first sight for both of myself and the bass, because the bass is used in all kinds of music. And while I was going to school and studying so-called legitimate, although I think, though, at this time, some 20 years later, all music is now being considered legitimate, I was able to experience all the different kinds of music because of my being able to play the bass. So I was able to find what pleased me, what gave me more satisfaction. It became a very that's what jazz is all about, by the way. It's personal. It's me. It's the individual who has a chance to be creative. Although there are different kinds of jazz bass players, there are jazz bass players who create the past. Recreate the past. There are those who are a combination of what's going on now, and then, like myself, I felt that I was liberalized by the idea that tradition is nothing more than bad habit. That if there was one place where I could be a rebel, not a pseudo-rebel, but a real rebel, it was that as an artist. And that's when I exercised and, I guess, expressed my feelings of frustrations about what's going on in this crazy world as a creative artist.
Your bass playing is unlike any other bass playing I've ever heard. I sometimes feel like you're making your instrument breathe and groan and moan. It's different than the usual walking bass we're accustomed to, or, you know, pizzicato or arco. It's just in a category by itself. Can you talk at all about how you got from what you knew through having studied it or hear other people playing to what you kind of, you know, like developed that you couldn't have gotten from listening to other people?
Well, I can remember one night feeling that I could take chances, that suddenly I wasn't bound by the so-called laws of what I knew, that that wasn't expressing myself, and I really had to express myself for myself. I might share with you that I'm a frustrated singer. I love singing. I appreciate this. In learning about music, once someone wrote an anecdote about how music began. It began with the wind blowing through the trees, the singing. That was the first song. And for me, jazz offers an opportunity for a person to sing on his or her instrument.
So it was trying to get that singing into your bass?
To extend myself through the instrument, right.
You mentioned that when you came to New York, there were two people who you most wanted to play with, John Coltrane and Ornette Coleman. And you ended up playing with Ornette Coleman when Jimmy Garrison, who had been playing bass with him, went to join John Coltrane, which I thought was greatly ironic. I'd really love it if you could tell us a little bit about what rehearsal sessions and recording sessions were like when you and Coleman and Moffat were a trio. How much was on paper? How much came out of the session itself?
Well, I remember once Ornette came in and we were rehearsing, that is, thinking of how to present a particular tune, and Ornette looked over at us and said, "You guys are lucky." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I've always got to play the same thing, the melody, but you can play anything you want to. Can you imagine you're being paid to play what you want to play?" And that, I think, really captured the essence of how we went. Ornette was extremely supportive of having us express ourselves through his melodies. And he is one of the most talented melody writers I've ever had the privilege and experience to hear, let alone work with.
Did he have a way of letting you know what he wanted you to do, how he wanted you to sound?
No. I would say that he had a way of expressing when it wasn't right. We all knew it. The interesting thing about the Ornette Coleman trio were little things like we were all left-handed, or we all had little things that we liked to do the same way. We're three different people, three different backgrounds, and yet we had the same idiosyncrasies, you might say. And I think that the similarity in taste, that intangible event, brought us close together, and it made it a very organic experience for all three of us. It was really a love affair.
The recording sessions, there's some really excellent music that is, happily still available on disc around. Were you happy with the producers that you work with? Did you have the kind of, freedom to play that you wanted to?
We had the freedom to play what we wanted to, but I personally was not happy with the producers because they tended to put themselves on a pedestal, and I felt they weren't really responding to me about my feelings about the quality of the sound, not what was played. As a matter of fact, I have no complaints at all, nothing but praise about the fact that we were respected as musicians and were allowed to play what we believed in and wanted to play.
Which are some of your favorite records that you are on?
I like them all, really. Each one had their own unique experience. The one, Sadness, that you played was our first European concert. I did that just after we got to Europe. In fact, I was on my honeymoon at that period. I just got married, and I was feeling extremely happy, and Ornette had come there. And I think Ornette really deserves credit for this, going to go about taking care of our own business, because the producers didn't believe that we were worth what we thought we were worth and wanted us to go on their terms, and that was not the way to go. So we got it together for ourselves on our terms, including paying to have this record recorded and finding someone to release it.
Now that's not a revolutionary concept right now, but I imagine it was back then, because artists didn't have their own record companies then like they do now.
That's true, yes.
You stopped recording for a while. The trio stopped recording for a while. Why was that?
For basically the same reason. Well, we couldn't get a recording done at the level that we wanted to do it at. And there was no point in doing it another way. This track that you heard, before it was sold, once Ornette auditioned this track for a well-known producer, and who said, "Oh, I like it, but I didn't know you had a string quartet on Sadness." So Ornette came back and said, "Now how can I release a record to this man who can't recognize a bass?"
Looking back, how do you feel about that part of your career, about the music, about, you know, the way your time was spent?
Liberating is the best word. It was a very liberating period because the trio offered all of us a chance to really be who we were and who we are and put it out there like it is, if you'll pardon those cliches, and to find acceptance at that level was extremely liberating and reinforcing toward our own growth.
How do you feel now about the evaluations that were made in the 60s of the music you were making, which I guess were really mixed, really ardent, and really...
Yes.
A lot of people just didn't understand it.
That's true. I find that the that I'm not particularly in favor. I'm not particularly respectful or disrespectful, but care that much about what a critic will say. The critic does not play, and that critic is expressing his or her opinion. And like some wise person said, the next day the reviews are used to wrap fish in or something like that. On one hand, the musicians who were very threatened by our music were reflecting their own sense of security. Remember, we're not musicians primarily. We're humans who are playing music. So I find that many of the musicians who love the way we played were saying, "Look, you're doing something that's different. I'd like to do it too," or "I've done it too." And then there were those who became very threatened because they either felt it was going to put them out of business, and that was, of course, not our intention. I mean, the world's too big. I'm waiting to hear what else is new that's going to come along.
Okay, well, let's listen to one of the tapes that we're going to be hearing, which is from your private collection of
yes, this
tape
was recorded.
Recordings.
This was recorded in Tivoli Gardens in Copenhagen, and I brought this recording because the trio was at a particularly high level of really good camaraderie, love, affection, and respect. It couldn't have been more beautiful. All of us were in love. Not only with love, but with each other and our wives and families.
And the piece that we're going to hear is called Clergyman's Dream. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Well, once again, Ornette wrote the melody, and this is a group collaboration in terms of arranging it. And it's very organic.
Okay, let's hear it. Ornette Coleman featured on alto, Charles Moffat on drums, my guest David Eisenson on bass. Been listening to a piece that's recorded and is in the private tape collection of my guest David Eisenson, who we just heard taking that bass solo. Also playing, of course, were Ornette Coleman and Charles Moffett. Where did you say that was recorded, David?
In Copenhagen. What I also wanted to say about it is that, as I recall listening to it, it brings back so many beautiful memories that I share with you and your audience. This was what we would call truly improvised music. Stopping and starting, getting louder and getting soft. We left the safety of habit, you might say, tradition. And Charles Moffett was there. You could feel him. He was extremely supportive. It's a wonderful experience.
What's your approach to improvising? I mean, like, how closely are you going to, like, stick to the chord changes or, you know, like, somehow, like, use the melody of a piece in your improvisation?
I just did a concert at the Public Theater in Manhattan with Ed Blackwell and Carl Berger and Ingrid Berger and myself, and we did it without any rehearsal. We went up and we improvised. We heard each other, we felt each other, and we played together. It was a beautiful, beautiful experience. When that philosophy is flowing, there is nothing more. I mean, the audience, everyone feels it. For recording, that philosophy doesn't always work. I mean, how often do you have the time to play a 20-minute track? So therefore, when we're recording, there's a different philosophy. As a matter of fact, I brought one of the tapes along, a solo bass tape, where I attempted to get in that philosophy of a limited time frame. Each tune has specific time frame, and the improvisation had to be done within that particular frame.
Yeah, we're going to be hearing that in a few minutes. I'd like to know what you listened to when you were young. You know, when you first became aware that you were hearing music. What kind of music were you hearing?
When I was young, 400 years ago, I heard the jazz of the 30s. I heard the music in my neighborhood in Pittsburgh, which was an integrated neighborhood, white people, black people. It was so integrated that I didn't know that there was a difference until I moved out of the neighborhood. We were human beings growing up together and sharing each other's music. I think that the Jazz at the Philharmonic series were great influence. I went to the local concert hall to hear the great traveling players, and I remember how moved I was by Lester Young and by Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker particularly was a favorite of mine. I never liked the drum war things with, say, Gene Krupa, the late Gene Krupa, and Buddy Rich. That never really got me excited. I'm more lyrically oriented myself. So I liked all of that. And I got moved by Tchaikovsky's music, by the way. Beethoven, his later works, became my favorite because during his time, the art of improvisation was alive and people were awarded prizes by judges for who could improvise the best. And Beethoven was the acknowledged champion. And what he did is to get his improvised thought down on paper. And that, to me, became the art and science of composing.
I've read in a couple of places the sound that you get is sometimes influenced by certain Hebraic things that you heard when you were growing up. Do you feel that that's true at all?
Yes, yeah? Yes. I think, though, that the bass, the idiomatic, that is, the qualities of the bass lend themselves to that minor romantic feeling. And I think that it's also part of my own nature, as it is.
Do you think that what you hear when you're young strongly affects what you're capable of playing as you get older?
Oh, absolutely. There is no doubt about the fact that the music that we all hear as infants and child have a great deal of influence on us because of several reasons. But one basic reason is those usually are the happy and comfortable times in our lives, and music does affect us that way. That's one of the reasons we listen to music, is to feel good. It takes us out of our problems and relaxes us.
Do you play music specifically for your kids?
Yes, I play with them. As a matter of fact, my son Solomon, who has a brain injury and who's getting better, I might add, can improvise on the piano, I just made a little cassette recording of myself playing bass with him playing piano, and you can hear someone responding very, very, very brilliantly with me.
Great. Well, I'd like to talk about that aspect of things in a little while. Let's listen to the two bass solo improvisations that you began to talk about a couple of minutes ago. We're going to hear two of them, and we'll come back to the studio in between each one. So why don't you say a few words about the first one that we're going to hear first?
Okay, the first one is called Dancing Alone. And that inspiration came to me when I watched people dance when they were no longer, was it body contact dancing? They were dancing actually alone, but together. And would see them moving and their eyes would be closed, so as if they were not actually dancing together, but still they were dancing together while they were dancing alone. And then I started to watch people walk down the street and found that that was another form of dancing. So I thought of the tempo, and then I became involved also with the 3-minute time form of recording, how I could improvise and get the message across. And I'd always played with the idea of doing a solo recording. So this was the first real attempt, and I was very fortunate to have a dear friend who owned a recording studio that gave me the time and the space to do and record this tune called Dancing Alone.
Okay, let's hear it. And this is performed by my guest, David Eisenson.
Thank you.
We just heard Dancing Alone, performed by my guest David Isenson. And we're going to hear another solo in a moment, this one an Arco solo called Weightlessness. But first, David, you said you had tried to make 2 3-minute improvisations, and I immediately thought, 45 RPM records. Was that your intention to, you know, try to make something that could, although it wasn't what we consider to be, you know, pop music, somehow like fit into that kind of format of both radio play and marketing?
I think that I was thinking about that. This was done about 6 to 8 years ago, and I might have even anticipated the kind of music that was going on, where the bass beat is a lot heavier than the disco playing, and I felt that if this were played in the disco atmosphere, of course there wasn't a disco atmosphere then, it would allow people to really get into moving their bodies around and flowing along with the notes, which is why I kept playing simply, so that each note offered a chance to relate to, mm-hmm. be related to, rather.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the next solo we're going to
hear? Yeah, Weightlessness. Interestingly enough, I got into people wanting to use dope, for example, and be in a place where they wouldn't feel any pain. It occurred to me, though, if you can't feel any pain, you can't feel any pleasure. There's a price you pay, and that they've got to balance off. In other words, to be vulnerable to wonderful, happy, natural pleasure, you're also vulnerable to pain. So I recorded this and wrote this theme and improvised on it, a weightlessness, where there was a place where one wasn't threatened by the pain and would be able to feel the pleasure. In recording this, I recorded it several times and was unhappy. Now, on this take, the first four notes took me 24 tries. That is, I played the first four notes, and I said, stop, take number two. And I got so frustrated that I remember actually starting to cry, that I thought I couldn't play the piece that I wrote. And on this 24th take, I played the first four notes perfectly, and the whole tune worked out that way.
Oh, great. Well, let's hear Weightlessness performed by David Isenson. Weightlessness, played by my guest David Isenson. You, you know, describing weightlessness and the piece we heard before that, Dancing Alone, had these just really visual, almost, reasons for having played what you were playing. I mean, there seemed to be a whole scene in your mind that the music evolved from. Does that happen, too, when you're improvising, you know, like, if we played an improvisation on one of your recording dates, that you'd maybe remember the images that you were thinking then, you know, or where it came from?
In fact, when I improvised, I would go into a place, a meeting hall, where everything was beautiful. And it would be as if I were in a trance, that my consciousness were suspended, and now the creativity was taking over all of its own, and it was a very pleasurable experience. And I got very frustrated, because why did it stop when music stopped? Why couldn't we humans have this experience as we are right now? We're improvising in a way right now. I'm not sure of what I'm going to say or what I'm going to be asked, or are you the same? And I felt that this had to be extended to all aspects of life.
Well, it's funny. The last time we spoke, you said that that was one of the reasons why you decided to study psychotherapy, and one of the reasons why you went for your doctorate in that and became a psychotherapist. Tell me, does it help? No, really. I mean, did what you learn there and what you're able to provide people, does it help you feel more intensely and during day-to-day experience, which, sure, it's sometimes really improvisational to just be alive. On the other hand, it can be filled with all kinds of hassling details and responsibilities that one would rather not do, and improvising through it doesn't necessarily make it any more enjoyable.
I wish I could give you a guarantee that it does work. I know that I chose psychotherapy because I wasn't really interested in getting involved with any gurus or any cults. I felt that science would have the answer. And I remember after my graduation sitting around thinking, now, why aren't I happy? I thought I'd be in a permanent state of bliss. And that was when I discovered that what I learned were tools that would help me deal with the stresses and strains of everyday life. And in that way, I would find a better state of being and not want to use any substances to medicate myself.
Did it help you not necessarily undo major problems, but just
I think it would have helped me was to stop struggling with what was going on and go with what is going on and see how I can make that better for me.
How did that affect your music?
Well, right now, in the most positive sense, I feel that now I play better than I ever played before in my life, and that I feel more natural, more honest. And that because I was able to look more directly at myself and my playing, I had an idea once that to get a grant for a computer program, we would take any and all jazz soloists, improvisers, and put on computers, their solos, and we'd find out that, much to our amazement, that most jazz, even the best, the most creative, only have a limited number of solos. And by computerizing it, in psychotherapy, one starts to look and listen very hard at themselves. And through this kind of awareness, they can, or I did, say, well, okay, I've played this. This is fine. Now I'm going to play something else and work at playing something else. Not let the demands of the commercial aspects make you stick with what gets applause like a seal does.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go into the commercial aspects of the music a little bit. How do you feel? What are your feelings about the relationship now of record companies and musicians? Has your relationship been a satisfactory one, you know, with the record companies you've recorded for?
Not at all. My relationships up to this point have not been satisfying at all, although I believe theoretically they could be and they should be. I made one record, and the record owner loaded up his car with the records so that there would be no record of the records he was selling directly to the record company. Therefore, we were not getting our royalties.
I don't understand.
All right. The record company owner of this particular, I mean, this was told to me by someone who saw this happening and asked me if I wanted to pursue it in a legal manner. At the time, I had not the time or the money. to do that, unfortunately, although on principle I really should have. And this is not an isolated case. For me, it involves many of my brothers and sisters who are players. We're the low person on the totem pole. We get the buck last, to put it quite directly. Now, what this record company owner did was very simple. He ordered, say, 5,000 copies of this record, paid cash for them to the manufacturer, put them in his car, went to the record stores, sold them directly for a profit that he made. Then when we came time to get our statements, oh, he only sold 10,000 copies, not 15 or not 25 or not 30,000 copies. This I find to be unfair. And musicians have attempted to change this by forming their own record companies. And they run into problems. Some are successful, some aren't successful. We still end up with the problem of distribution. As a matter of fact, my fantasy about becoming involved with music again will be when I find someone who I can trust that will take care of the business for me. It is not within my bailiwick to be the business agent, the administrator, the salesperson, and then the artist. I need all my time and energy to be the artist, and I think that it's possible to have a collaboration. And if it's not worth everyone's while, we shouldn't do it.
One of the groups that I would have loved to have heard that you organized, but that didn't record, was your quintet with Barry Altschul and Gatto Barbieri and Carl Bergam. It was a quartet. Was there a fifth person?
It was Carlos Ward. Was also a part of it, too.
To the public, to people like me, if I haven't seen a group perform and if they haven't recorded them, I mean, they might as well just have not existed.
Yeah, that's true. I did make tapes, and I was looking for one particular tape that I wanted to bring and share with you, and I couldn't find it. But you're right. Recordings are extremely important, and it's a problem, I think, that hasn't been resolved yet in many people's minds.
Was it frustrating for you that you didn't record as a group, or were, you know?
Yes, it was. It was frustrating with me at the time. But we had such great pleasure playing. We worked in New York and surrounding territories at now a club called Slugs that no longer exists, and the Boheme, the Vanguard, the Village Gate, and places like that. We had a terrific time playing and had a very... I wanted to call a group instead of the Eisenson Quintet. I wanted to call it the Mutual Admiration Society because we really felt that way. You can really sense that about players when they have a love and respect for each other. And so many of their producers, what they do is they get their ideas in their heads. The ideal group should be X, Y, and Z. So they call up X, they call up Y, and they call up Z. And then the music comes on, and they're in the studio, and then that's the end of that. And I think that's why there's some of the quality of the jazz is at the level.
That's an interesting comment. Well, let's listen to another tape that you've brought with you today, something that's not available on record. This is from the private tapes of David Eisenson. We're going to hear something that he recorded along with clarinetist Perry Robinson. You want to say a few words about this session?
Well, talking about love, Perry Robinson, myself, and have known each other since 1962, right after I came here into New York City. We've just have been brothers with each other through all the years. Now, after I came back from touring the world, we went around the world twice with Ornette, and then I at that time stopped and gone back to school. I wasn't sure what I was going to be doing with my musical career. And then I started to rehearse with Perry and Randy Kaye, a young drummer at that time, who had since gone on and played with Jimmy Giuffre and recorded with him. And we used to rehearse at my house, and this is a tape from one of the series. It's a complete collaboration, which is the level that I feel music should exist.
Okay, let's hear it, and we'll hear Perry Robinson on clarinet, my guest David Eisenson on bass. Mm-hmm. We just heard a recording from the collection of my guest David Eisenson. That's not from a record, it's just one of his private tapes, and that was a session that he recorded with Perry Robinson, featured on clarinet, and Randy Kay on drums. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Eisenson, who is a bass player and also a psychotherapist. You may have heard him on records or in performance. He performed here in Philadelphia just about 2 years ago. And also has recorded with the Ornette Coleman Trio. You also may be familiar with him through another aspect of his work, which is called Pot Smokers Anonymous. That's been written up in many newspapers, and he was even on the Tomorrow Show about a month or so ago with Tom Snyder talking about this group. Maybe we can get into a little bit of that now, David, though I do hope that you'll be coming back again later in the week to talk more extensively on this. As I said the last time we spoke, it just seemed really, and it still does, very ironic to me that someone involved in jazz, which is a music that has, for better or for worse, been linked to drugs for many years, that someone involved with jazz is, you know, forming a group to help people stop smoking dope. And we're not talking about heroin. I mean, we're not talking about a severely addictive, degenerative drug. We're talking about dope, which people, you know, smoke and listen to records or go to concerts, watch movies, cartoons, you know. Considered to be a pretty mild thing. Why are you so adamant about this?
Well, I've seen too many people in the past several years who found that through their own experience that the drug had a more insidious quality than they were led to believe. Just what you said, when you were comparing it to heroin, many people have switched over from that to pot, thinking it is quote-unquote less dangerous, or from alcohol, it is less dangerous. Well, quite frankly, it's like changing chairs in the Titanic. It does have an adverse effect on the system. 30 years ago, just barely 30 years ago, we didn't know how harmful tobacco was for our systems. And by the time we found out, it had already become a habit. Don't forget that when you smoke, you are bypassing your natural filter system, which is your nose. You're going directly into your lungs. And recent findings, and by the way, within this next year alone, there's going to be more clinical research on the pharmacological aspects of pot than in the past 200 years. And I am for people, not against pot. That's basically my position.
You know, the studies that have been done in the past, some of them always just used to amaze me. Like, they'd force-feed someone a gram of hash and then give them, like, reading comprehension tests where you have, like, you know, three absurd paragraphs on, you know, like, crops in Brazil, and then you'd get, like, six questions about these crops, and if you didn't answer them accurately, then they said, okay, well, hash obviously, you know, upsets the whole neurological mental system in a human being. It should be illegal. Crazy studies like that.
I think those were very unfortunate. You're absolutely right. The scientists who did that, who were morally wrong for doing that. And in fact, in Pot Smokers Anonymous, what we learn is that there really isn't anyone out there. When I see or talk to a pot smoker who is having breathing problems or concentration problems or memory problems or even something more insidious, like not having any ambition or motivation, wanting to go to school or continue on with their school, those are the people who can tell you that it has not been the benevolent substance that we once thought it was. And what happened in Pot Smokers Anonymous is that we developed a strategy that will enable people to be successful, because most of the people had attempted to stop smoking and were unable and unsuccessful. So a specific strategy had to be developed. We don't ask you to give up smoking, because nobody wants to give up their old buddy, their old friend, their old goody. We ask you to think of what you can get. And what you can get is a sense of self, a real sense of self, that ironically will let you, when I say ironically, music, which is a part of my life, it is my life, it's designed to get you high in the sense of taking you to a better place. And it's ironic to think you have to smoke dope to listen to it, to enjoy it, or smoke dope to play it. So that, and it's not true. However, the mind can develop these bad habits, and that's what we have to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this some more, hopefully, on Friday.
Great.
I'd just like to briefly talk about another very important aspect of your life now, and that's your life as a father. About 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago maybe, your son Solomon was born, and he was diagnosed as being severely mentally retarded, which I imagine has had a very strong effect on the way you live your life.
Oh, yes. It affected me in the sense that we were told by the doctors that he was a severely retarded infant and that we should consider putting him away in an institution and forgetting about him. And my wife and I felt that this was not could be satisfying or suitable for us in any way, shape, or form. And one night, sitting and thinking about it, I saw that this was going to be a full-time, primary, number one career in my life was to get this son better. Now, it's really funny. Philadelphia has been the city of brotherly love, as many jokes have been made about Philadelphia, just as Pittsburgh. And I remember being here in Philadelphia 2 years ago when the Flyers, I think, won the cup, as it was. Everybody was really happy, and your basketball teams, and now the Rose and is coming here to join the team. However, in my mind, what really will make Philadelphia famous is the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential, where we take our son. This is the court of last resort. These people are not afraid to fail. They are afraid to not try. And it's through their work and teaching us to do the program that our son has gotten a new lease on life. We've been on this program for close to 5 years. Solomon is now 7 years old.
Oh.
And it's been through this last 5 years that we have dedicated ourselves to getting Solomon better. So as a result, I've limited myself in terms of my traveling. A jazz musician's home is where he plays, not where he lives. And that's one of the reasons why I no longer travel and play. As a matter of fact, the record that I recorded with Paul Motion was the first time in 10 years that I had traveled to Europe where the record was recorded. So I'm happy to say that right now Solomon is doing much better. In fact, he's winning, as the case may be, considering the alternative is the losing. So I think your beautiful city one day is going to be known. That's the place for the Achievements Human Potential is known, because they have people coming there now from all over our globe to this place. It's a wonderful place.
Well, it's really thrilling to hear that that your son is making so much progress. I'm really glad to hear that. I'm really afraid just about out of time. I sincerely hope, David, that you can join us again a little later in the week. We're thinking probably Friday at around 4, but we'll have to see if that works or not. So I'll let everyone know tomorrow on the show whether you can make it then or not, because I'd really love to speak some more. What we'd probably do is talk some more about Pot Smokers Anonymous and David's thoughts about dope, and we'd probably also open up the telephone line. So if you're kind of sitting there now by your radio saying, oh boy, do I ever agree or do I ever disagree, hopefully Friday at 4 you can join us on the phone and tell us firsthand what you think about all this. David, it's been a great pleasure to have you here. Hope to see you again later this week.
All I can say is that the time passed so quickly that it must mean that it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time, and thank you, too.
Thank you. I've been speaking with David Eisenson. He is a bass player who has recorded with Ornette Coleman, spent many years with the Ornette Coleman Trio. He's also recorded with Paul Modian, and we'll be closing the show with a segment of their record. He's also a psychotherapist, and through his work with psychotherapy, has founded the group that he now calls Pot Smokers Anonymous, which we hopefully will be talking about some more a little later in the week. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon on the show at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by a Philadelphia-based jazz pianist and composer by the name of Ron Thomas. At 4 o'clock tomorrow in the show, we're going to be joined by Rod McEwen. Now, you probably know he writes poems and stuff. He also owns a record label called Stanion Records, for which he has purchased the rights to a lot of long out-of-print records, and he'll be bringing some of them with him tomorrow for us to listen to, including some really fine work by Noel Coward. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can join us then. The technical director for this afternoon's Fresh Air has been Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air's production assistant is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Bob Edwards with All Things Considered.
Thinking what a glorious death if a man drowned in one of these vats.
What? Well, there was a story of a man who fell into this, you see, and he came out twice for a pee before he died.
It's a vat full of whiskey, you see. I've heard of a man in my soup, but that is ridiculous. Single malt whiskey denied on All Things Considered in vats, outside of vats, how you manufacture it, and why it's considered the very best scotch.
Also tonight, Tehran is relatively quiet, but the second largest...